Hello, everyone, and welcome to our reading of the Associated Press News for Friday, August 21st, 2026. My name is Al Freeman. Our first AP headline, Court Slashes $50 Million Judgment Against InfoWars Alex Jones Over Falsely Calling a School Shooting a Hoax. The story is datelined Austin, Texas. A Texas court has slashed the $50 million judgment to just $1.5 million against InfoWars founder Alex Jones over falsely calling a 2012 school shooting a hoax. The ruling does not affect a $1.4 billion judgment against Jones in Connecticut, but is a significant legal victory for Jones after he and his company, Free Speech Systems, were found liable for damages for claiming the mass shootings didn't happen. The unanimous opinion by the Texas Third Circuit of Appeals, Court of Appeals, found that Sandy Hook parents Neil Heslin and Scarlett Lewis did not show evidence that harassment inflamed by Jones' hoax claims rose to a level that would allow them to exceed the state's $750,000 cap on damages. Heslin and Lewis's six-year-old son, Jesse Lewis, was among 20 children and six educators killed in the 2012 attack in Newtown, Connecticut. The lawsuit and 2022 verdict against Jones marked the first time Jones was held financially liable for peddling lies about the massacre, claiming it was faked by the government to tighten gun laws. Jones' trial attorney, Andino Reynal, said he would appeal the damages amount and predicted shortly after trial that he could get it reduced to $1.5 million. Jones and his company have filed for bankruptcy, and those legal proceedings are continuing. Our next report is headlined, Two U.S. Army Corps of Engineers workers among eight killed in small plane crash in Alaska near radar site. The story written by Becky Borer, and the dateline is Juneau, Alaska. Two U.S. Army Corps of Engineers employees were among eight people killed in a small plane crash near the site of a remote aircraft tracking radar in western Alaska, the U.S. military said. The agency had charted the plane, which crashed Thursday near its destination, the Cape Newnham long-range radar site airport, approximately 450 miles west of Anchorage, Alaska. The two pilots and six passengers were not immediately identified. The twin-engine Cessna 441 had taken off from the Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport, the Federal Aviation Administration said Friday. This is a devastating loss for our military family and the communities we serve, U.S. Air Force Lieutenant General Robert Davis, the commander of Alaskan Command, the Alaska North American Aerospace Defense Command region, and the 11th Air Force, said in a statement. The NTSB and the FAA are investigating the crash. It happened in foggy weather, according to information compiled by a service that's part of the Flight Safety Foundation, a nonprofit. The airport is a private military site. The radar site is managed by the Pacific Air Force's Regional Support Center. It's part of a network of remote radar sites that tracks aircraft operating in Alaska's airspace and along its borders, the statement from the Alaskan Command said. The statement did not provide details on the specific work the individuals were doing. Davis described those on board as dedicated professionals carrying out a vital mission in demanding environment. Our absolute priority right now is providing unwavering support to their families, friends, and teammates during this devastating time. We are profoundly grateful for the swift and tireless response of our search and recovery professionals. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska posted online that the flight was operated by Security Aviation, an airplane charter company based in Anchorage. An email was sent to the company Friday morning seeking comment. I join Alaskans offering condolences as we learn of the plane crash in Cape Newnham, Murkowski posted Thursday night. I've traveled extensively with Security Aviation throughout Alaska and have met many of their experienced pilots. I appreciate the U.S. Coast Guard NTSB, Alaska State Troopers, and the Rescue Coordination Center for responding to the site. Alaska is praying for those on board, their loved ones, and the security and the team at Security Aviation. In 1950, a Continental Defense Radar Station was built at Cape Newenham as part of the distant early warning line to warn of Soviet attack during the Cold War, according to Coastview, a science education nonprofit that promotes understanding of the Alaska coast. Little remains of the former station today. Associated Press writer Kathy McCormick in Concord, New Hampshire, contributed to this report. Becky Borer is a statehouse and political reporter based in Juneau, Alaska. Our next AP story is headlined, Cleanup Underway After Tornadoes Touch Down in Delaware and New York's Long Island. It's Dateline, New York. Cleanup efforts and damage assessments were underway Friday in Delaware's capital and on Long Island, New York, after tornadoes touched down during storms that battered the Northeast with heavy rains and left dozens of people stranded in their cars during flash flooding. Officials said there were no reports of serious injuries. The National Weather Service said a trained spotter reported a tornado in Dover, Delaware, during Thursday storms. Photos and video on social media show the roof of a motel being blown off and damage to other buildings along Route 13 northeast of downtown. In Atlantic Beach on Long Island, images posted on social media show a large funnel cloud over the water and a small building torn apart at the beach club. The Weather Service confirmed a tornado touchdown on the shore, saying it started as a waterspout over the Atlantic Ocean. Weather Service crews were going to view the Delaware and Long Island damage on Friday to determine the strength and the paths of the tornadoes. Dover Mayor Robin Christensen said a state of emergency was lifted Friday morning to allow residents and businesses to resume normal activities. Police urged residents to be patient and set aside extra time for travel. There is still debris throughout the city, and crews will be out working on cleanup, repairs, and restoring services. You may encounter blocked lanes, utility crews, emergency personnel, and other delays, police said on social media. On Long Island, Nassau County Executive Bruce Blakeman said first responders rescued people trapped in their vehicles during the flooding. In other parts of New York, flooding caused part of the Long Island Expressway in Queens to close in both directions, according to New York City Emergency Management. Photos on social media showed lines of stopped cars as emergency crews traversed the weather. In Jersey City, New Jersey, emergency crews rescued 69 people trapped in cars that were overtaken by flash flooding, said Mayor James Solomon. Emergency crews used small inflatable boats to reach people who were stranded. Our next AP headline, enrollment in SNAP grocery aid is dropping faster than expected. The story written by Jeff Mulville Hill and Michaela Schuter. It's Dateline Phoenix. Enrollment in the biggest federally funded food aid program in the U.S. dropped by more than 13% in a 12-month span, a decline far steeper than the government estimated as work requirements and other provisions of President Trump's Big Beautiful Bill, as it was called, take hold. Those losing coverage in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, included people who don't meet the tightening requirements to participate, and advocates say some who qualify for the help but are rejected because they miss deadlines or don't have the needed documentation handy. It's too early to tell exactly how many fall into each group. It's also unclear how many have lost coverage because some state agencies that run the programs are overwhelmed trying to keep up with changes. That was the case in Arizona, which saw the nation's largest enrollment drop. Tia Fields, who analyzes social safety net policies at the advocacy group Invest in Louisiana, said the main reason she's seeing people lose coverage is not failure to meet work requirements. A lot of it is administrative paperwork, she said. Proponents of welfare reform hope The role reductions are driven by people earning too much to keep qualifying, a sign that policy changes are behaving as intended for a program they assert is riddled with fraud. If these people that are leaving the welfare rolls because they're working and they're moving forward, said Rachel Sheffield, a research fellow at the Conservative Heritage Foundation, which pushed for stricter requirements for SNAP, that would be a step forward. Arizona has the steepest decline so far, with a 12-month drop of more than 50%, according to data compiled by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which runs SNAP. The decline was more than 20% in Georgia, Louisiana, and Nevada, and in Florida, where the Department of Children and Families said in a statement, the decreasing number is reflective of the state's strong focus on advancing opportunities for Floridians and their families to achieve economic self-sufficiency. SNAP helps more than 1 in 10 people in the U.S. buy food. Most of the beneficiaries have incomes below the poverty line. The monthly benefit, which is delivered on debit cards that can be used only for groceries, is $344 per household on average. Newly released federal data found SNAP enrollment fell from 42.2 million in May of last year to 36.6 million this May, a drop of more than 13% in a year. The May data are primarily and could be revised. Since 2010, the average number of monthly beneficiaries has been below 40 million for only 2 years, 2019 and 20. The roll started dropping after a recent peak of 43.3 million in October 2024. They've fallen much faster since implementation began last year for Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill, which cut taxes and overhauled social safety net programs. The expanded SNAP would require a requirement has now been kicked in for more of the country, but it won't begin in some places until next year. Many adults 54 and younger without minor children have long been required to work to get SNAP benefits. The new law requires most people who previously have been exempt from the requirements to either work, volunteer, or go to school to get benefits. It now includes those aged 55 to 64, those with children ages 14 to 17. Those 65 and older with younger children than 14 remains exempt, as do those with health limitations. Some other groups that had been exempted from the requirement, including homeless people, no longer are. In February, the Congressional Budget Office projected that the new requirements and other factors would push SNAP enrollment down over the next decade, falling below 34 million by the year 2036. But the nonpartisan office did not expect the drop to be as fast as it's been. By May, the number of people receiving benefits was about as low as it was forecast to go in 2030. Experts expect another impact when states are required to pay part of the cost of benefits if their rate of payment errors, which recipients receive more less than they should, is above 6%. Advocates for recipients say states may deny benefits to some people entirely rather than risk errors. The cost sharing is scheduled to start in October of 2027, though Congress has considered a delay. In Arizona, enrollment plummeted by 55% from April of 25 to this year, the biggest drop in the country, with more than 400,000 fewer people getting benefits now. The state said the drop was driven largely by the state's own struggles putting new federal requirements in place. Implementing the federally demanded changes triggered unexpected and unprecedented calls, volumes, and administrative hurdles, including additional verification requirements, creating a real barrier for applicants, said Brett Bezio, a spokesman for the Arizona Department of Economic Security. Bezio said that hiring more staff members and introducing ways for people to submit their documents online have stemmed the enrollment drop in recent months, as the state has reduced the chance for people who qualify to lose benefits. In Phoenix, La Diamond Lopez lost her benefits in January, with officials telling her she needed more documentation about her income and household, something that's needed for officials to determine whether enrollees meet work requirements. She's been skipping meals and some bill payments to ensure her children have enough to eat. In her quest to be reinstated, she had previous employers sign forms confirming she no longer worked for them and added her children, ages 3 and 9, to her apartment lease. She expected payments to resume in August, but she didn't know if they'll last. "I was approved at the end of May, but now they're asking me for more documents," she said. "It's a panic." The Heritage Foundation, so Sheffield, says that some of the drop in SNAP use is likely a natural decline after peaks in the coronavirus pandemic era. Paco Velez, the president and CEO of Feeling South Florida, said the 22% one-year enrollment drop in Florida is driven partly by immigrants who are in the U.S. legally, but fear being targeted by Trump's immigration crackdown if they're seeking government benefits. Invest in Louisiana's field said SNAP enrollment declines have broader consequences. For instance, children in households that receive the benefit can be automatically enrolled in free school lunch programs or in the SNAP for Women, Infants and Children program for low-income mothers, young children, and expectant parents if they meet the other criteria. "What happens when that child can't pay for lunch?" she asked. Some food banks have ramped up donations to try to meet a demand that they say has risen as SNAP rolls have declined. But isn't expected to bridge the gap fully. "We're worried about it because we know that other organizations or programs can replicate the scale and success of SNAP," said Carolyn Vega, a policy analyst at the advocacy group Share Our Strength. "We know that schools cannot fill this gap. We know that food banks can't fill the gap either." Schulter is a core member for the Associated Press Report for America Statehouse News Initiative. Report for America is a nonprofit national service program that places journalists in local newsrooms to report on uncovered issues. Mulvihill was reporting from Haddonfield, New Jersey. He covers topics on the agendas of state government across the country. He has focused on abortion, gender issues, and opioid litigation. Kella Schuletter is a core member of the AP Report for America as well, the Statehouse News Initiative. The next AP report is headlined, "Trump warns of economic D-Day against Iran, but Tehran is well acquainted with sanctions." The story is written by Farnoosh Amiri, and the dateline is New York. Nearing the six-month mark of the Iran war and facing diminishing stockpiles of key weapons, the Trump administration is touting a crushing financial campaign against Tehran, promising an economic D-Day against a country that has so far withstood nearly 5 decades of punishing American sanctions. With sparse details, President Donald Trump announced this week the U.S. would be imposing an unprecedented level of economic warfare and isolation on Iran, aiming to force its leadership to cave to demands to end the nuclear program and fully reopen the crucial Strait of Hormuz to oil and natural gas tankers. It reflects the dire reality Trump faces with an increasingly unpopular war that he can't seem to end. Just months before a pivotal midterm election that will decide whether his Republican Party keeps control of Congress. Whether out of desperation or strategy, the president is refocusing America's might on bringing Iran to its knees through an accelerated sanctions campaign against one of the most economically penalized countries in the world. The immediate response from Iran hawks has been praise and a call for patience as it plays out, while other analysts warn that Trump is refusing to learn the lessons of his predecessors. In an interview Thursday on CNBC, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent offered a small glimpse of what may be ahead, threatening secondary sanctions on nations and companies that conduct business with Iran. He did not say exactly whom would be targeted as part of his next phase of the administration's Operation Economic Fury, which earlier had focused on entities and individuals that buy oil from Iran, the bank with Iran. China and India, however, are major buyers of Iranian oil. If you insist on doing business with them, then the U.S. Treasury and U.S. government will put its full might and force against you, Besson said. It's time for our allies and the rest of the world to make a decision. Some experts see uncharted waters that could force Iran's hand. Despite decades of U.S. sanctions against Iran, the Trump administration is arguing that it's only a matter of time and that striking the right economic target would get Tehran into breaking point. Richard Goldberg, who coordinated efforts to put diplomatic pressure on Iran in Trump's first term, said the consequences of U.S. strikes on Iran's nuclear sites last year, the war this year, and the American naval blockade on Iranian ports have created the perfect storm for a capitulation, one that didn't previously exist. I think we're watching a strategy, whether it takes a short time or a long time, that is very much about fundamentally changing the future of the world by seeing the end of this regime, said Goldberg, who is now at the hawkish Washington think tank Foundation for Defense of Democracies. I caution everyone, including myself, who has worked on sanctions, who's worked on financial warfare, to have the humility to admit that we are in uncharted waters, he said. He also said the decision this week by the United Arab Emirates, one of Tehran's most important trading partners, to suspend trade with Iran over an alleged missile attack will only further isolate the government. Beyond trade in domestically produced goods, the Emiratus has helped the country absorb some of the shocks caused by sanctions through its re-export hub. With nearly all of Iran's energy, financial, and transportation sectors already covered by U.S. sanctions, Trump's aim appears to be to apply secondary sanctions on countries, including allies and partners that have not cut all ties with Iran, to starve the country of any remaining income it may still be receiving. In many ways, it's a redux of Trump's first-term maximum pressure campaign, which he helped ramp up during his second term to include military action. But as Trump and his allies discovered during his first administration, it can be difficult to enforce secondary sanctions without harming U.S. interests and provoking reciprocal measures. There were numerous instances of the administration granting sanction waivers to countries, particularly those that rely on Iranian oil for their energy needs. Trump's strategy now rests on targeting Tehran directly by impeding its touch points and access to the formal financial system and international economy, said Benham Bentablu, senior director of FDD's Iran program. This will require making the Iran issue more important in U.S. bilateral relations with countries in Europe and Asia. Iranian officials and analysts have accused the Republican president of flip-flopping with his latest pivot to economic pressure against Iran. Trump has long derided past leaders who used sanctions to limit Iran's ability to pay for its military and nuclear development. In a post last week on X, Esmail Baghaei, a spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry, wrote that Washington's pattern of retreating to sanctions when it doesn't want to pursue diplomacy has proven to be futile. Iran has demonstrated over decades that it will not be strangled by these exhausted refrains, he said. The real risk is that American politicians clinging to this bad habit will instead strangle their own remaining chances of less humiliating exit from a crisis of their own making. Ali Vaez, the Iran director for the International Crisis Group, said the Trump administration's decision to take its own maximum pressure policy to new heights with military action seems to ignore years of U.S. foreign policy lessons that show Iran does not respond well to pressure. If anything, he says, the latest economic campaign has only hardened Iran's position. I think Trump's blind spot is the fact that the only thing that the Iranian regime views as more dangerous than suffering from U.S. sanctions is surrendering to U.S. terms, Vaez said. Plus, the past year of start-and-stop diplomacy has only worsened the already fragile dynamic between the longtime adversaries, Vaez says, adding that Iranian officials' lack of trust in Trump and his mediators has created an untenable foundation. They believe that even if they capitulate to U.S. terms under economic duress, Trump would move the goalposts and ask for more, he said. And this really is the fundamental problem. Pressure without an open door is an exercise in futility. Associated Press writers Matthew Lee and Fatima Hussein in Washington contributed to this report. Farnoosh Amiri covers foreign policy and the United Nations as a correspondent for the Associated Press based in New York. Our next headline from the Associated Press. Cuba says U.S. sanctions are blocking its efforts to open the economy to private investment. The story written by Edith M. Lederer. The dateline is the United Nations. The United States has demanded that Cuba open up to private investment, and Cuba has passed sweeping reforms to encourage just that. So Cuba's U.N. ambassador says he wants to know why Washington keeps piling on sanctions that stymie the very economic opening it has sought for decades. Ambassador Ernesto Sabellon Guzman, in an interview this week with the Associated Press, directed his question to U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, the main architect of the Trump administration's Cuba policy. What are you afraid of if you are so convinced and the Cuban government is an incompetent government? Why do you need to implement almost every 2 weeks new sanctions? The U.S. State Department responded to a request for comment with a quote from Rubio saying new sanctions will continue to be announced every couple of weeks to close off escape valves that they're trying to create in every mechanism. That's a quote. Then on Thursday, the U.S. imposed more economic penalties on Cuban industries, targeting state-owned mining, metal, and construction companies. Cuba has been pushed to the brink by an oil blockade imposed by the United States in January on top of a decades-old embargo, coupled with escalating sanctions. The moves by President Trump's administration, meant to put pressure on the government by depriving it of funding, have worsened already debilitating blackouts, cut workers off from public transport, crippled infrastructure, and deepened shortages in medicine and food in the Caribbean island nation. Guzman said the sanctions are the main obstacle to Cuba opening up its economy. He said the impact of the U.S. measures, specifically the shortage of electricity and a lack of fuel to run a business or travel, has turned off investors and tourists, a major source of Cuba's income. Some companies have pulled out of Cuba, including the Spanish hotel chain Melia, which relied on tourist revenue and cited significant operational, legal, economic, and financial difficulties in explaining its decision to leave. Literally, the United States has done everything imaginable to try to prevent foreign investors, said William Leo Grande, a professor at American University and a leading expert on U.S.-Cuba relations. When they say, well, we want to see Cuba open up its foreign investment, they're being disingenuous. It's not possible for them to succeed without some kind of sanctions relief. The goal of Trump's Republican administration, he said, is not just to open up Cuba economically, but to overthrow the Cuban government, to change the nature of the Cuban political system. John Kalovich, the president of the U.S.-Cuba Trade and Economic Society, said Cuba had to make changes when it lost its economic lifeline with the U.S. ouster in January of Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro. The result is the Cuban government in the last 8 months made more commercial, economic, and financial changes to the country than they have as a group since the revolution, he said. Nonetheless, the Trump administration keeps ratcheting up sanctions, putting more pressure on Cuba, which is responding by making more changes, Kalovich said. But from our standpoint, there are two parts missing. One is Cuba implementing by regulation everything that it's announced, and secondly, the Trump administration allowing U.S. companies to have more access to the Cuban marketplace while these changes are underway, he said. The changes announced by Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel, which in June aimed to significantly shift Cuba's economy and industry, which had been strictly controlled by the socialist government since the 1959 revolution. They include more space for private businesses, imports and exports, without the state as an intermediary, free hiring of personnel, authorization for private banks, investment by Cubans abroad, and opportunities for fast food chains to establish themselves on the island. Guzman said there are opportunities for investments in real estate, solar farms, and energy to help ease the country's electricity shortage, as well as in marinas and the tourism industry. Christopher Hernandez Roy, acting director of the Americas Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, recalled that the last economic opening under President Barack Obama's Democratic administration, quote, was later throttled by the Cubans themselves, who feared that the opening went too far and appeared to threaten political control. Today, he said, it appears the Cubans really do want economic reforms and outside investment. Díaz-Canel's economic reforms are not possible, but U.S. sanctions significantly constrain their prospects for success, Hernandez Roy said. He noted the irony that U.S. pressure is helping push the Cubans toward greater economic liberalization of necessity, while simultaneously limiting the resources and access necessary for those reforms to actually improve the economy. In late June, after the reforms were announced, the U.S. slapped sanctions on five state companies, three linked to a business conglomerate run by Cuba's Revolutionary Armed Forces. Best known as GAESA, it's believed to command nearly 40% of Cuba's gross domestic product. Rubio, a former U.S. senator from Florida whose parents were born in Cuba, did not appear to be impressed by the newly announced economic changes. He last month called Cuba a failed state with a bad economic model. He said Cuba's leaders don't know what they're doing and don't know how to fix their economy. I think the challenge that Cuba has faced for the last 15 years is they want to somewhat improve the economy, but they're afraid that if they improve it too much, they'll lose political control over people, he said. The United States is prepared to do what we can do to effectuate positive change in Cuba because it directly impacts our national security since it's only 90 miles from the U.S. mainland, Rubio said. And we want Cuba to be prosperous. We want Cuba to be free. The Cuban ambassador said implementing the economic changes would be a far easier thing without sanctions if American companies were involved in Cuba and if trade between the two countries was possible. He said the good news is that talks are taking place between the United States and Cuba. He declined to give details of what he called very sensitive conversations. But the point here is that even when Cuba is changing a lot, Guzman said, the U.S. government keeps the same policy of aggression toward the Cuban people. Now our next AP headline, Vance will campaign at the Ohio steel plant where his grandfather once worked. The story written by Michelle Prince and Julie Carr Smythe. And the dateline is Middletown, Ohio. Vice President J.D. Vance will return to his hometown Friday to campaign for Republican candidates at the same steel plant where his grandfather used to work. Vance is set to speak at the Cleveland Cliffs Middletown Works facility, which was known as Armco Steel when his grandfather, James Vance, worked there for nearly 40 years. Vance has highlighted his Rust Belt roots while trying to boost GOP candidates ahead of the November midterm elections and to promote the Trump administration's economic policies and efforts to try to expand U.S. manufacturing. The Middleton event comes as he's expected to ramp up his travel schedule with more public events and fundraisers, according to a person familiar with the plans who was not authorized to speak publicly and discussed it on condition of anonymity. In a radio interview Thursday on the Clay Travis and Buck Sexton show, Vance said Friday's stop will be personally very meaningful because of his family connection. He said it was an amazing opportunity for me to go talk about, frankly, plants like this wouldn't exist were it not for some of the Trump administration's economic policies. Vance will be joined by U.S. Secretary of Energy Chris Wright. Said he will also use the visit to stop by some Cincinnati chili restaurants. In his best-selling memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, Vance described the steel plant as an economic savior for his family that brought his grandparents from Kentucky's hills into the American middle class. He described how his grandfather, known to his grandchildren as Pawpaw, would boast when he saw an old Ford or Chevy that its steel was made by his company. His grandson's election as Vice President of the United States spurned pride in the Midwestern city, though Vance has faced some pushback to his portrayal of it in the book. He said kids derisively called it Middle Tucky. When his family and a child, because it had so many transplants like his family, he said they brought problems with them from Kentucky, such as drug addiction, Mountain Dew mouth, and problematic fathers. In the 2024 election, Trump and Vance won about 62% of the vote in the city's precincts. His mother, Beverly Akins, and his sister still live in Middletown. Ohio has lost its political bellwether status and turned red during the Trump era, but Democrats see a chance to win both the governor's office and a U.S. Senate seat from the Republican hands if this year's anti-Trump sentiment buoys their party. Republican Senator John Husted, who was appointed to replace Vance in the Senate, is trying to hold on to his seat against a challenge from former Senator Sherrod Brown, a longtime Ohio politician with a pro-working-class message who lost his re-election bid to Republican Bernie Moreno 2 years ago. Brown has capitalized on public opposition to data centers in the campaign and aired ads calling Husted the face of data centers in Ohio. The National Republican Senatorial Committee, the GOP Senate campaign arm, warned in a memo this week that backlash to the centers has left Husted vulnerable. Vivek Ramaswamy, a Vance ally, is the party's nominee for governor in a race against Democrat Amy Acton. Democrats have not won the Ohio governor's office in 2 decades. Vance, whose family still keeps a home in Cincinnati where they sometimes spend weekends, is making his first public visit since his fourth child was born in July. As part of his plans for ramping up his travel schedule, his office announced a trip Monday to Brewer, Maine, where former Republican Governor Paul LePage is running against Democrat Matt Dunlap, the state auditor in a competitive House district. Michelle Price reported from Washington. She covers the White House and previously covered the 2024 presidential campaign and politics, government, and other news in New York, Nevada, Utah, and Arizona. She's now based in Washington. Julie Carr Smythe covers government and politics from Columbus, Ohio, for the Associated Press. She was part of the AP team honored as a finalist for the 2025 Pulitzer Prize in breaking news. Now, another political story from AP. The headline, President Trump to stump for Senator Darlene Graham, days ahead of South Carolina's GOP Senate runoff. The story written by Meg Kennard and Dateline Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. President Donald Trump is scheduled to travel to South Carolina Friday to make a last-minute appeal for Senator Darlene Graham, his chosen candidate to replace her brother, the late Senator Lindsey Graham, ahead of a Republican runoff next week. Voters will decide Tuesday whether Graham or Representative Ralph Norman will be the Republicans' nominee on the November ballot. The Myrtle Beach rally is the sort of campaign trail occasion that Trump has not done much of this year compared with past midterms, making it a signal of the importance he's placing on a win for his pick. It's also an opportunity for the president to wade into friendly territory ahead of the midterm elections that leave his party's control of Congress hanging in the balance. South Carolina has not elected a Democrat statewide in decades. Its House delegation has only one Democrat, and Trump's own victory in the 2016 presidential primary here helped propel him toward the nomination and ultimately the White House. In the scramble of a Republican primary, election that was called after Lindsey Graham's sudden death last month. Darlene Graham was picked by Governor Henry McMaster, also a Trump ally, to serve as interim senator and entered the special primary at Trump's urging. The president had said he told McMaster that appointing her would be a fabulous tribute to Lindsey, although the governor pointed out that he asked Graham to serve in the wee hours after her brother's death, adding that Trump thought it was a great idea when he later told him of the pick. The president pressed Run Darlene Run on social media and gave her his complete and total endorsement before she'd officially announced her campaign. And at every turn on the campaign trail, she's reminded voters of this anointing as well as her commitment to advancing his priorities if elected. On the eve of the primary 2 weeks ago, he held a telerally for Graham. Trump also considered Lindsey Graham a close ally and friend, though they ran against each other in 2016 and had their ups and downs, so part of the visit is personal for Trump. He eulogized his longtime golfing partner and wartime conciliaire at Washington National Cathedral last month. A political newcomer, Graham has stressed that she's not a politician, as she's hurriedly introduced herself to voters across the state. Regularly touting her support for Trump's policies, as well as his endorsement, she has pointed to her years heading up a state agency, as well as her weeks on the job in the U.S. Senate, as evidence of her readiness. Saying she's answering President Trump's call to serve, she has repeatedly said she wants to fight for President Trump's agenda, and cited his core goals of border security and passing the SAVE Act voting bill as among her top priorities. Graham has said she's focused on kitchen table issues like gas prices and household spending rather than international affairs. Earlier this week, after stumbling on an elemental foreign policy question related to U.S. interests in Taiwan, Graham defended herself as not a polished politician. Trump has made no comment on the gaffe, which garnered attention after Graham told moderators, "National security is not my thing." By meeting voters in Myrtle Beach, both Trump and Darlene Graham are aiming to capitalize on a growing part of the state that's known to be deeply conservative, loyal to Trump, and full of new residents. It's also the home district of Representative Russell Fry, the House ally whose name Trump has floated as an outstanding possible replacement for Graham after the senator's death. Elected to the House in 2022 with Trump's help, Fry ousted a five-term GOP congressman who had voted to impeach Trump a year earlier. Running in the Senate primary, Fry touted his support for and previous backing from the president, but was hampered by the absence of it in this race. Finishing third, he swiftly endorsed Graham, a calculated move for the 41-year-old, two-term congressman who is dating the origins of his 2022 election, has seen the ramifications for some Republicans who have crossed Trump. Meg Kennard covers national politics for the Associated Press, and she lives in South Carolina. The next headline from AP's politics pages: California lawmaker Aisha Wahab wins special election to succeed Eric Swalwell in Congress. It's written by Sophie Austin, and the dateline is Sacramento, California. California State Senator Aisha Wahab will serve out the rest of former Representative Eric Swalwell's term after securing victory in a special election. Swalwell, a Democrat who was running for California governor, ended his campaign and resigned from Congress in April after he was accused of sexual assault and harassment, which he denies. Wahab will represent the state's 14th Congressional District, which covers parts of Alameda County on the eastern side of the San Francisco Bay, through Swalwell's term ending in January. She will be the first Afghan-American to serve in Congress. The progressive Democrat defeated Bay Area Rapid Transit Director Melissa Hernandez, even after a swell of spending by outside groups opposing Wahab in the race's final stretch. She said her victory shows her district cannot be bought. "I will fight for this district that raised me," Wahab said in a statement From foster care to Congress, this journey shows the possibility of the American dream. The conclusion of the race to replace Swalwell comes as criminal investigations continue into the sexual assault allegations he faces. Over the weekend, federal agents seized electronic devices from Swalwell at the San Francisco airport and later searched his home in Washington, D.C., according to a person familiar with the matter who was not authorized to publicly discuss an ongoing investigation and spoke on condition of anonymity. Swalwell's attorney did not immediately respond to an email and phone message seeking comment. Wahab became the first Afghan-American elected to public office in the United States when she won a Hayward City Council seat in 2018. She has championed housing affordability and access in her time in the legislature and throughout her campaign. She also wrote a bill in 2023 to ban caste-based discrimination, which garnered national attention. Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom vetoed it, saying such discrimination is already outlawed by civil rights protections. Wahab and Hernandez will face off again in a separate November election determining who will serve the next full two-year term. Wahab won the June primary decisively, but outside spending in favor of her rival poured into the race ahead of the general election. Groups affiliated with the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, spent millions in supporting Hernandez and thousands into opposing Wahab. At a candidate forum in April, Wahab answered yes when asked if she considered what is happening to the Palestinian people to be a genocide. Hernandez did not give a straight yes or no answer. She said Israel had a right to defend itself following the October 2023 attack by Hamas, but that the destruction into Gaza has gone too far. Hernandez, a moderate Democrat, said she was proud to put up a competitive fight after Wahab's success in the primary. I've been a fighter my whole life, and when I promised the residents of California 14 would fight for them, I never gave up, she said in a statement. Associated Press reporter Alana Durkin-Richer contributed from Washington. Sophie Austin covers California state government and politics for the Associated Press. She reports on environmental, education, and reparations policy. From the AP's business pages, this headline, schools are starting to teach AI literacy. For many, that means helping kids see the flaws of chatbots. The story written by Jocelyn Gecker and Russ Bynum. The dateline is North Charleston, South Carolina. Artificial intelligence chatbots have become the bane of teachers everywhere, but to prepare for the new school year, a group of educators in Charleston, South Carolina, packed into a high school auditorium and talked about inviting AI into the classroom. The teachers and principals watched as an instructor prompted an AI tool to create a map of the world. The result drew gasps of disbelief and laughter. Projected on a large screen was a map riddled with bizarre errors. Mali was spelled male. Egypt was identified as Sopf. In place of Libya was something simply called Africa. Dozens of other countries' names were misspelled or written in pure gibberish. If you ever want kids not to overtrust these tools, try the map demo, said the instructor, Amanda Bickerstaff, founder and CEO of AI for Education, an organization that helps schools draft AI policies and train teachers and students in what she calls safe, ethical, and effective use of the technology. After initially trying to ban AI use, a growing number of U.S. public schools are trying a new strategy, encouraging classroom experimentation, partly so students can see its shortcomings, including the generative AI's notorious tendency to hallucinate or fabricate information. AI literacy has become a buzzword of this back-to-school season as educators try to strike a balance between equipping students with the skills they need for an AI-driven future while preventing them from outsourcing their thinking to chatbots. There is no single definition of what AI literacy means or how it should be taught. Tech giants like OpenAI, Google, and Anthropic offer schools training sessions in how to use their AI tools. But for educators, there is a growing consensus that AI literacy is about more than learning how to use generative AI and write good prompts. Good AI literacy, said Rebecca Winthrop, director of the Center for Universal Education at the Brookings Institution, includes knowing when not to use it. Some districts build their own approaches. 37 states have now published official AI guidance that schools can use as a blueprint. South Carolina, though, is not one of them. So the state's second largest school district has set out to do it on its own, said Lucas Clamp, the deputy superintendent of the 50,000-student Charleston County School District. It's been a huge endeavor. A year ago, the district contacted AI for Education, which helped draft guidance for Chicago Public Schools, Houston, and dozens of other districts. Phase one was laying the groundwork, and the district developed an AI policy, seeking input from teachers, students, and parents. The district organized student focus groups and learned that student AI was ubiquitous but unguided. Teachers and students said they were navigating the technology on their own and wanted clear rules and instruction. Studies show a majority of teenagers and teachers nationwide are using AI for schoolwork, but they're teaching themselves how not to use it. Very few say they have a technical understanding of it or have received formal training in how it works. Schools and parents are eager to avoid mistakes made with social media, where kids were left to explore the online world without learning about addictive algorithms, comparison culture, and other downsides that have been linked to a youth mental health crisis and dwindling attention spans. As the school year begins in Charleston, phase two kicks in, training. Teachers and middle and high schoolers will get a mix of online and in-person instruction on how AI tools work and how to use them effectively. The student course walks through the familiar scenarios, like asking a chatbot to help with a research paper, to show that generative AI might deliver wildly inaccurate information, including made-up studies with unflinching authority. Always verify any factual information you get from Gen AI, especially for your classwork, the course advises. A section on data privacy cautions against sharing personal information with AI tools because conversations can be stored, used for data training, and potentially leaked. High school teacher Ray Naur said attended the research summer training and left with teachable moments for his AP research class. He plans to show examples of AI bias and hallucinations to fuel student discussions. We're all trying to figure this out right now, what's the right balance so we don't scare students away from AI, but don't encourage them to run to it, Naur said. We have to teach students. You can't just get an answer and move on. You have to use analytical skills and dig deeper. Utah was an early pioneer in taking a statewide approach to AI in education. In 2024, the Board of Education named Matt Winters as its AI education specialist, making Utah the first state to create a full-time position overseeing the technology in schools. Over the past year, Winters led AI training for over 7,000 teachers, almost a third of Utah's public school instructors. He is helping districts shape AI policies, which they are required by state law to have in place by July of 2027. There's a clear method from the top in Utah, said Chris Agnew, director of the Generative AI for Education Hub at Stanford University. When you're tackling big change, it's easier to have coherence if everyone is signing from the same hymn book. A handful of other states have since replicated Winter's post, including Maine, West Virginia, and Georgia. In other states, a patchwork of AI approaches has emerged, with variants from one school district to another. Extensive AI literacy training requires steep investment, raising concerns that kids are under-resourced, districts might not get that same attention. In Utah, training starts with the basics of how AI works to teach an understanding of AI bias, hallucinations, ethical concerns, and data privacy needs, Winter said. Teachers can then pursue additional training on specific tools. If I had to give advice, figure out how to make a training accessible to everyone, said Emma Moss, who oversees AI at the Canyon School District and also led an 8-person team that traveled the state doing over 150 AI literacy trainings. The training was funded by a $500,000 AI literacy grant from a local healthcare provider. We said we will come to you, whether you're in a rural area or urban, it didn't matter. The state has also played a key role in procuring AI tools, Winter said. He negotiated data privacy agreements along with discounted prices, which has allowed rural and under-resourced districts to get access. Everyone needs to understand what this technology is and how it works, said Winters, who cautions against blanket bans. AI literacy is much larger than saying, don't use AI. It's about how we can prepare kids for the future. Changing adult mindsets is also a key, said Christina Yamada, the State Board of Education's digital technology specialist. I think teachers need to change their mentality about students using AI to cheat, Yamanda said. There has always been cheating, she said. It's up to teachers to speak students' language and convince them they can't rely on AI for all the answers. For younger kids, it means starting to talk about AI early with conversations like, people can lie, a program can lie, and a robot can lie, she said. You've been listening to our reading of the Associated Press news for this Friday, the 21st of August, 2026. Thanks for joining us. My name is Al Freeman.